Welcome back to the What's Up ABQ podcast. In this episode, we'll continue where we left off with Nate the EMT, and you'll hear some of the strangest and most chilling calls he's had to make as an EMT.
It's something I think about all the time.
You just want to
the
know.
Two little eyes looking at me through the door, answering it, and then like, what in the world's going on upstairs? I have no idea.
It's What's Up ABQ.
Albuquerque, this is Lindsay.
This is Lorenzo.
And this is What's Up ABQ.
All right, we're back.
We are back. So we kind of wanted to talk about some calls. I know that people are really interested in the nitty gritty and kind of knowing about the interesting stuff that happens on the job. So I want to ask you a couple questions. First of all, I want to ask you, what is the weirdest call you've ever gotten? And then the other question I have for you is, what is the most ridiculous call you've ever had?
Okay, so the craziest call I've ever had would have to be we responded to a house fire. You know, that's pretty rare. You actually don't, the fire department will respond to a lot of house fires, but most of the people get out of the house and so there's no like medical patient there, but in this situation, the people weren't able to get out of the house. And so we were called for the victims of the house fire. And when we got to the scene, these people were standing out in their front yard and they had been basically mortally wounded in the fire. And
So when you say mortally wounded, can you explain what that means for people that are kind of like, what is that?
That basically means there's no way that they're going to survive their injuries.
Okay.
So they were so severely burned that there's just no way they're going to survive. I mean, you're still going to do, don't miss the message, you're still going to do everything you can for these people off of the chance that maybe they're not mortally wounded, but your approach to making sure they're not in pain takes a higher priority. So these people are severely burned head to toe, and they are very, very alert, which is when I realized that that was different than a lot of the different types of medical emergencies we respond to, because in a lot of the other different types of illnesses and injuries, it results in some blunting of their mental status. So they may not be aware of their condition. So like, even if, let's say you're bleeding to death, you don't have adequate blood flow to the brain. And so you're a little bit stuporous or confused, not totally aware. Car accidents where you have a head injury, you've been knocked out, you're confused. But in this situation, they were completely alert and aware, you know, able to talk, able to speak, and also, I think, very aware that they were probably mortally wounded. And so the fire had burned almost all of their clothes off. The woman was standing there and she only had a bra. The fire had burned everything else off. And the man was just wearing a belt. And
just about
because all of his clothing
else burned off.
Had been burned off.
Yeah.
And so they were just in so much pain. They were screaming at me. And, you know, you don't get that call a lot. You don't have a lot of training on that. And there's a lot to think about to treat them medically. And so, of course, we wanted to get them to the hospital quickly and treat their pain. But it was just, I think it was the first time I had really experienced a patient who was likely going to die, knew that they were going to die, knew that I knew they were going to die, and it just made it very, very difficult. And to make matters worse, I was a newer paramedic, so it was a very difficult call to have as a young medic, for sure.
So, and I'm sorry if this is too graphic, we don't have to go there.
Yeah.
But if somebody is in that state and you know there's nothing you can do, is your priority just to keep them comfortable, or what do you
we're
do?
We're still going to do everything.
Like, what's the order of operations, I guess?
So the order of operations is the same for every patient, in the sense that in order to maintain life, we know that you have to have an open airway, meaning that your mouth has to be open, taking in oxygen and breathing out carbon dioxide. You have to be breathing adequately. Your heart has to be beating adequately and circulating blood throughout your system. So paramedics really take the approach of supporting the vital life systems. So making sure the airway's open. If they're not getting enough oxygen, giving them oxygen. If they're not breathing adequately, helping them breathe adequately through using a ventilatory device. Or if their blood pressure is low, giving them IV fluids to raise their blood pressure, things like that. So we're gonna do everything that we can. And there's certainly treatment algorithms for all of those different illnesses and injuries. And we're always going to try even if we think that they're not going to make it, we're going to follow the treatment algorithms to give them the care that they need. Yeah. But there's just, you know, knowing in your head they're probably not going to make it. You definitely want to make sure that they're comfortable. And so if the guidelines allow you to give them, you know, at the time we gave morphine, you know, so that was the medication for pain control.
Do you guys have like a chaplain with you or a chaplain on call that you can contact, or is that more police? I'm sorry.
That's more police fire. Okay. No, that's a great question. Police fire, but they tend to be involved more when the person dies at the scene.
Okay.
So, you know, they'll show up to help discuss issues with the family. Of course, they're always available to us if we should need them as well.
Oh,
but,
wow. Yeah,
I didn't know. But, you know, I think the hard thing about this job is like running that call, taking that patient to the hospital, turning them over to the doctors mm-hmm. and the nurses, and then being like, now what? I guess we'll go put our ambulance back together and there will be another call for us in 10 or 15 minutes and you just move on. Mm-hmm. And you don't always get feedback or follow up on how the person did, and that can be really difficult.
So one thing that you said that was pretty interesting to me was that the chaplains are there not just for the victims or people involved, but for the paramedics. So you had mentioned that you were younger and new to the field, and you had this call and pretty fresh, I guess. So, I mean, how did you respond to that at the time? And to me, any regular person, that's traumatic. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I absolutely.
Secondary trauma.
Yeah, I absolutely have some of that. So there's a few mechanisms in place. So when I say the chaplains are there for you, I mean, that's definitely like not their primary role. The primary role is going to be there for the family or the patient in need. But there has definitely been situations where all of those needs are met and a chaplain had asked me, are you okay, or do you need to talk or something like that. But we also have like on-duty supervisors who will, when you've had a call like that that's really bad, if they're available, they'll respond to the hospital to meet with you and say, how are you doing? How are you okay? You know, are you okay? Do you need to talk about this? We have like free psychological care. So there's a group that we work with that offers free counseling, and they are specialized in providing counseling to first responders. And so they are really, really good at it. And I've definitely had my fair share of therapy over the years. I think what's hard is you don't really know. It's you don't have any idea how you're going to respond to it, because it's not the first 1 to even 48 hours after that type of call that you realize it, you know, that it didn't sit well with you. It's, and then it can be really hard to untangle it all, to figure out like, well, what is it that bothers me? I've actually had quite a bit of therapy and counseling to work through it, because for me, what happened is my brain took the culmination of all these horrible things that I saw over almost a 20-year career and would be like, I'm just going to mix it all together and give you a terrible nightmare. And it won't be a real call that you ran, but it'll be this soup of all these elements of bad things. And I'm going to make it
all the negative stuff.
Yeah, I'm going to make it really horrific. And so one of the therapists I worked with was really, really good at like consolidation of traumatic memories and helping you work through and processing these in a way. They do things like EMDR. I don't know if
I've done EMDR. It's really effective.
Yeah, they do stuff like that. So unfortunately, I think a lot of first responders do respond to alcohol or even drugs for coping, and that never helps. For me, what has been the most helpful was having a therapist skilled in first responder intervention. And we've come a long way. There's still a stigma with that, but a lot of people are talking about it now and are at least willing to say, hey, I think I need to talk to somebody. There's also programs like critical incident stress debriefing, but even that, like the model on that has changed. It used to be you need to make sure an emergency provider gets that within like 72 hours from the traumatic incident. Now they're realizing that's not always helpful, like especially if the provider's like, I don't want to talk about it, I'm okay. Like, you know, sometimes you will see something bad and it doesn't bother you, and then other times you see something not so bad and it bothers you and you're like, why does this not so bad thing bother me? And who knows, the workings of the mind are complex.
Oh yeah, it's crazy.
That's a lot to unpack.
Definitely.
You know, that's a lot to unpack.
Yeah.
But I think it's important to address, you know, that first responders are people too. You have stuff you take home from work with you, and you have stuff that you need to unpack and deal with and sort out, and And again, everybody deals with their trauma differently. And it can come out at different times in different ways. And we don't always know how that works. And so having the ability to talk to somebody and knowing that those people are out there is really important too.
Yeah, definitely. I know we had one more question about stories, and I'm like, as we're talking about this, I'm thinking about like other questions.
That's okay.
Ask away.
Yeah. So what was the weirdest call you ever ran?
Okay. So the weirdest call I've ever ran.
He's like, all right, let me tell you. He's getting comfortable in the chair.
This is a crazy story. Like, I actually like telling this story. So we got a call in the middle of the night. For many years, as I worked night shifts, and we got a call in the middle of the night for an unknown problem. And so this might be, it could be something like, oh, there's this guy lying on the side of the road. I don't have any idea what's wrong with him. And so the 911 dispatchers are like, this guy lying down. We don't really know what's wrong, but this concerned citizen is called, so unknown problem, go figure it out. But sometimes people will call 911 and they're in a way or a state that they're not actually able to explain to the dispatcher what the issue or the problem is. You know, sometimes people call 911 and hang up, this kind of thing. So unknown problem, and in the middle of the night, we respond to basically like a condominium. And remember when we were talking about all the pre-arrival things you can do, like turn your lights on, open a door, have a waiver? Like, none of that is happening. Like, me and my partner pull up, this house is completely dark, or condominium, you know, we can see the condominium number, and we both look at each other and we're like, I wonder if we have the wrong address.
There's no action here, nothing's happening.
And this happens, right? Yeah. You get the wrong address, and so you're like, you know, hey, can you confirm the address for us? And they're like, stand by. And they're like, yep, copy. And they repeat the exact address that we're at. So we're like, okay. So we unpack all our gear and we go knock on the door. Nobody answers. So we're like, knock again. Hello, ambulance. And then the door creaks open and we see this pair of eyes peeking at us through the door.
It's always promising.
And we're like, ambulance, did you call? And this man opens the door, and he just has, his eyes are like as big as dinner plates. He doesn't say anything. He opens the door, he looks at us, and we're like, did you call 911? And he doesn't answer us. He turns around and walks and sits down at his kitchen table. He just leaves the door open. So we're like, I guess that's our invitation to come in. So we're like, hey, you know, I'm Nate. I'm a paramedic. What's going on? How can I help you tonight? And this person is just out in left field. Like, nothing they're saying is making any sense. We're not really able to figure out, like, why we're there, but clearly they're not acting
like
right.
Like, something's wrong, you just don't know what it is.
We can sense, like, something's wrong with the computer. Like, the brain isn't working quite right, but we're not really sure why we're here. We're not sure who called us, and we're trying to get information. And they're just, their answers to responses to our questions are not appropriate. So we'll be like, you know, are you hurting anywhere? And they'll be like, I used to have three dogs. And you're like, oh, okay, good to know. Are you sick? Are you feeling sick? And then they would say something, you know, I don't remember all the answers but this person was giving, but like, I like chicken stew. And we're like, okay. Like, so finally we're able to communicate enough with this person that we determine they want to go to the hospital, and we decide what hospital they're going to. And they basically ask if we can get a jacket for them. And so I'm like, yeah, I'll get your jacket for you. So where's your jacket? And he says, oh, it's upstairs. If you go up my stairs, there's two bedrooms. And it's in the bedroom to the right. And I'm like, oh, okay. So I start to go up the stairs, and my partner is staying down with the patient in the kitchen. And as I start to walk up the stairs, I get this feeling, this very dark feeling of like impending doom. Now, I'm a realist. Like, I don't believe in the supernatural. I don't believe in ghosts. You know, I only believe in things that you can measure using scientific instruments.
I believe in science.
You don't have an EMF reader? Come on.
Yeah, no, I didn't have my EMF reader.
Clearly we've done our research.
But I start to walk up these stairs, and I just get this ominous feeling, and the hair on the back of my neck stands up, and I feel doomed. It is like the strongest feeling I've ever felt. And so I get to the top of the stairs.
I right out of there.
Yeah. Well, and you just, jeez. You know, it's hard to say. Like, I think there's times that I had similar feelings and then nothing happened. So we just disregard that data and throw it out of our mind. But this time, so I get to the top of the stairs. Remember, there's two bedrooms at the top of the stairs. And one of the bedrooms is clearly this man's bedroom. And the other bedroom is this little boy's bedroom. It has not.
I hate where this is going. I hate it.
It has not been touched or updated in like 20 years. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like old things. It looks like a museum. And so I'm like, well, that's not the room I need to go in. I need to go in the other room and get the jacket. So I go into the other room, and there are all these pictures on the floor. Old, like, Kodak pictures on the floor. And there are pictures of this man with this little boy. And so I'm like, I don't know the story here. This little boy, does he not live here anymore? Did something horrible happen? I don't know, but you get the sense that there's this, like, shrine of a bedroom over here and all these photos on the ground. So I try really hard to, like, mind my own business. I get the guy's jacket. I come back downstairs, help him put on his jacket. We're getting everything, you know, together to leave. And as we're leaving, my partner's like, hey, Nate, turn off his stove. Now, this is bizarre because one thing we're really good at is this, is like coming in and being like, oh, the stove's on, let's turn that off. Or if a TV's running and we can't hear you, we'll turn off the TV. We do these things. And I look over, and this gas stove that was right next to the table where we performed our initial assessment has a burner just completely on. And I'm like, there's no way I wouldn't have seen this when I walked in the house. How would I not have seen this? And I'm like, okay, yeah. So I go and I turn off the stove, and patient says, that stove hasn't worked in 20 years.
Oh, hell no.
And so I'm like, well, it does now. Completely terrified. So we get in the back of the ambulance. We take him to the hospital. He's acting bizarre the entire time. We drop him off with not a very good explanation to the hospital staff. We're like,
we don't know why we're here, but the stove was on.
Yeah, like, we don't really know what's going on, but definitely.
We got the jacket. I don't know. We got the jacket.
Yeah, we got the jacket. He has what we call altered mental status, which means they're not acting right. And we're not sure. So they wanted to come to your hospital. So here you are. So we get done with the call. And I'm talking to my partner. And this was somebody that I didn't regularly work with. Didn't know them that well. And I was like, you know, I don't really believe in like ghosts or like spirits or anything paranormal. But I got this like really ominous feeling when I was like going up the stairs to get this guy's jacket. And the person that I was working with says, well, you know, I do believe in that stuff. And I got an ominous feeling as soon as you left, and I was rebuking the devil the entire time.
Oh, lovely.
I just think it's really interesting that there was like strange things happening at this house, that we both had this like this gut feeling that something wasn't right. Never really got any closure on this, but it's something I think about all the time.
You just want to know.
The two little eyes looking at me through the door, answering it, and then like, what in the world's going on upstairs? I have no idea. You know, what's with the stove that's not supposed to work? That's
for 20 years,
yeah,
but all
actually
of a
working tonight. It was just bizarre. One of the calls I never ever made sense out of. I would love to know more about that story. Obviously, that was many, many years ago. So I don't even know how I would track that information down.
Wow.
There's like so many creepy elements to that. Like, where do you even begin? Because there's so many creepy things.
Everything. Ugh. Like from the start, you know, like this dark, like, I don't think we're at the right place. Turns out we are at the right place, but not able to get the information.
Well, also you're like, who made the call? Like, even like if the man was like, I don't, you know.
We never
like,
got that in. We never figured that out. Like,
so weird.
You just have to kind of go with what you are getting, you know? So at some point, this guy's like, take me to the hospital. And we're like,
wow.
Okay, well, what hospital can we take you to, you know? And then, of course, they're kind of irritated at the hospital because they're like, wait, you don't know what's wrong? Nope, don't have any idea.
Like, the job was, I got the jacket and I turned the stove
that's
off
right.
And that's all I know.
That's the job, yep.
Did you ever see that Nicolas Cage movie? Was it a Nicolas Cage movie?
Yeah, it was Bringing Up the Dead. It was Bringing Out the Dead. It was a Scorsese.
That is a Nicolas Cage movie about EMS.
Like, yeah. Did you ever watch that?
I have. Yep. Okay. And
I'm sorry. Now I'm like.
No, that's a good movie. I had watched it. I watched it, and at first I read the book.
Oh, it's a book.
I was new at EMS, and somebody said, you should read this book. So, I mean, I'd been in EMS like a year, so I got the book and I read it, and the sentiment was, I don't get it. Then I watched the movie, and the sentiment was, I don't get it. And then after about 8 or 9 years on the job, somebody was like, you should revisit the book and see the movie. So I did, and I was like, I get it.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah, it's just, there's just weird things in there that, like, you wouldn't understand unless you'd done the job for a really long time.
Yeah.
No. That's kind of how I felt about the movie. Like, it was entertaining, but I remember thinking, like, okay.
I thought it was, like, all right. I mean, I got uneasy feelings, and, like, there's a scene where Nicolas Cage, he's, like, caffeinated up, and he's, like, they have that, like, montage sort of scene, and he's, like,
I don't know. When he's trying to resuscitate the old man, and he's, like
disassociating from his like, himself.
They're, like, doing CPR, and he's, like, did your husband like music? They're like, yeah, and he's like, music helps sometimes. And he has them like, they're playing like Sinatra off the radio while they're doing chest compressions. Right. Yeah,
no, that was a good scene. But I think I was thinking about the scene where he was in the ambulance, and mostly it was like driving scenes, and he's like really erratic. And
it's because because it's trying to show that he's like exhausted, like he's on the brink of just like straight exhaustion. Yeah. Like he's like, it's like caffeine and no sleep, and he's just like, he's just plowing through the night. But it's just like,
for sure. That happens a lot, and you know, sometimes you feel like, for lack of a better term, dizzy, because you've been going like in every which direction, and sometimes you're in the back of the ambulance, you have no idea where you are, where you're going, you know, and so it can be very disorienting. Yeah. And they're long shifts, you know, they're 13-hour shifts, and for some systems longer, 24 hours, 48 hours, you know, fire department does 48 hours here, and you may not have had adequate, you know, hydration, adequate nutrition. It's, I totally get all that.
Your brain does funky things when you're lacking sleep.
You know, at one point I thought about going to school to be like an EMT or a paramedic, and the thought of like, I'm sorry, this is going to get dark for a second. So if you're listening with your family, maybe skip through this part. but no, I thought about, you know, like dead bodies. I am not into that at all. I don't think I could handle that. I think that would be really hard for me. And then kids. I think that would be the hardest thing, is to see kids. And just, you know, like having kids myself, I think that would be really, really difficult.
I would say kids is very, very hard. Dead bodies, it depends on the circumstances. People die, right? We all die.
Yeah.
So if you see somebody,
sterile view of death, and
yeah, we do.
You know,
but if you see, like, if you see somebody who was elderly who likely died of natural causes, not too disturbing.
Yeah.
You respond to a suicide call or maybe a murder scene, different ball game. Drug overdoses, different ball game. You also get used to it though, and you get. I mean, I don't know if desensitized is the right word. You adapt.
Right.
Is like the right word.
You just know more what to expect. Or you kind of just, it's not as shocking to you.
And the whole thing of like, is he dead or mostly dead is a thing, right? Remember the Princess Bride? Like, he's only mostly dead. Like, we assess to see, is this somebody who's died recently in like the last 15, 30 minutes, and do they have a chance at resuscitation? Or is it somebody who's been dead for several hours? And if they've been dead for several hours, then there's no amount of resuscitation. So it can be very clinical at times, where you're trying to determine, how long do I think they've been down, and do I need to go ahead and begin resuscitative efforts or not?
Have you ever seen anything that, and I don't want to go into that realm too much, but something, have you ever seen something that is like miraculous, or something that is like, whoa, that blows my mind, and I literally don't know what that's about?
I've seen several things like that over the years, and some of it would be kind of hard to explain if you didn't have a lot of medical training, so I'll leave those ones out. But I remember I responded to a call where a guy had been traumatically wounded, had been shot multiple times with a gun, and he had gross hemorrhage, so he was grossly exsanguinated. And we do have a guideline that says if there are no signs of life and they are grossly exsanguinated.
Does that mean like they're bleeding out?
Yeah. So the average adult male.
I'm not a doctor, but you know.
Right. So the average adult male has about 6 to 7, maybe 8 liters of blood in their system. And so if you're looking at 4 to 5 liters of blood around the patient and they don't have any signs of life, you can't miraculously get all that blood back into them. So our guidelines say, you know, if they don't have signs of life and they're grossly exsanguinated, then don't resuscitate. So we'd got to the scene and the fire department was there first, and they had started CPR and they had provided ventilations to this patient, but he was flatline, right? So we talk about, you know, not a rhythm you're gonna shock. He's flat. We call that asystole is the medical term. So me and the fire officer discussed, and we decided that he met the guideline for what we call obviously expired, meaning they've obviously died and we're not going to resuscitate. And so we tell the providers who were working on him, we say, go ahead and stop. Like, you know, he's grossly exsanguinated and he has no signs of life. And so everybody understands. And we're packing up the medical equipment, and they still have him on the heart monitor. And while they're like packing up all their gear, I look over and his heart starts beating out of nowhere. That really doesn't happen very often. It happens if you give epinephrine, you know, adrenaline. That happens sometimes after you shock somebody, but just based off of some chest compressions and ventilations alone, that doesn't happen too often. And then there's a circumstance where the heart monitor can show a heart rhythm, but you still don't have a pulse that you can actually feel, which you would expect because this guy doesn't have any blood in his system, right? So we see the heart rate on the monitor, we reach down and feel for a pulse, and he has a pulse. So we're like, huh. So we put him in the ambulance and transported him to the hospital. Now, he didn't make it, but just that whole experience was really strange, and I don't know that, I never saw anything like that. You know, it was not unusual if you'd given him a lot of epinephrine or if you'd done a lot of procedures, but to only just do a few rounds of chest compressions and some ventilations and then for the heart to suddenly start back up was really strange.
Wow. So that's intense. I was thinking about a couple of other questions before
I like we how you're like, well, that's intense.
Sorry, I just had to. No, Nate, you paint a really great, great picture.
What's going on in my
so
mind?
Like, I'm so like, I'm kind of there. So yeah. So I guess kind of wrapping up, I was thinking about this in some of my like previous work. You know, we think about these horrible like emergency situations that you never want to be part of, right? If you're not, I mean, EMS, like it's going to happen. But if you're not EMS, like I'll just give you an example. So one job of mine, they required us to get CPR certified, and I think it was Burlingame County Fire. They came and they taught some courses, and you know, they had the dummies, and we did the CPR, and then they had the fake what's the shocking things?
The AED.
Yeah, yeah.
Automated external defibrillator.
Right, right. And they taught us how to use it, and we got a little keychain, I guess, that has this like sterile thing that you put over their mouth in case you don't want to like touch their mouth if you're giving CPR. For me, I'm like, if somebody's dying, like I don't really care. But either way, so CPR in another scenario, but both related. I was a teacher at APS and at a high school, and they handed out tourniquets, you know, just in case there is a shooting and I have to apply the tourniquet. You never want to be in either one of those situations, but how important, I guess, is it from the point of when somebody is hurt to when the point EMS arrives? Like,
talking about like a critical window of taking care of somebody, or?
Yeah, like I don't want to hinder any sort of efforts. I guess
if somebody collapses and they don't have a pulse, they're not breathing, and they don't have a heart rate, you can't make that a whole lot worse. But you can potentially make it better by providing immediate CPR. We do know that bystander CPR, meaning that somebody who's not an EMS responder, we know that when a bystander provides CPR, they have a better outcome. They're more likely to survive. So do your best. Like, you're not going to make it worse. If you think they need a tourniquet, apply it, because we can always come behind you. And if we decide it's not needed, we can take it off, right? There's definitely been a lot of circumstances where somebody started CPR and the patient's like, whoa, like, get off me. So like, if they don't need it, you're going to know pretty quick. They're going to start responding to you. So I would say when you think about medical emergencies, time is a really, really important component. So we have a phrase that we often say, that's time is muscle, or, you know, time is brain. Like, if you're having a stroke, time is brain. If you're having a heart attack, time is muscle. And so, I mean, sometimes you'll know what to do. Other times you won't know what to do. And I would say, don't just do something because you think you have to do something. If you've been trained to do something like CPR or apply a tourniquet and you think it might be indicated, then I would do it. The chances of you hurting them are pretty slim. Abdominal thrusts, formerly called Heimlich maneuver. If somebody's choking, you're probably not going to hurt them, but you might save their life if they're really choking. If they're choking or they appear like they're choking, you know, a good question is, do you need help? Do you want me to help you? Because sometimes they're able to resolve it on their own through coughing, and then you grab them and start squeezing them and you could injure them or something. But if they are really legitimately choking, then do your best. Like, yeah. Absolutely.
That's funny. You just unlocked a memory that I buried a little bit in my training about do you need help? That was the only thing that I thought was kind of funny. Like, the first thing that you do is like, do you need help? Like, if they're like choking or whatever. So
you're supposed to just encourage them. You're supposed to be like, keep coughing. Yeah. You're doing good. Yeah. And then you stand there.
Man.
Yeah. You stand.
Don't
there
use that
in
word.
Case,
yeah, maybe not.
Right. You stand there in case they collapse. Right.
Yeah.
So if there's one thing you could tell Albuquerque as a city, before we wrap up, what would you tell them? Every single person in this entire city. no pressure.
I would say, like, there are a lot of times that you don't need 911. But if you're in doubt and you think you need help, we're there to help you. There are definitely times that people feel ashamed for calling us, and you should never feel ashamed. If you think you need help, or you think you're in a bad way, or your family member's in a bad way, we're there for the community. That's why we exist. And, you know, call 911. Sometimes it's okay to take a couple minutes to just be like, what's going on? Do we need to, you know?
If your pizza's late, that's not a reason.
Right. If your pizza's late, that's not a reason. If you are trying to get a doctor's appointment for a problem that's been going on for 6 months and you can't see the doctor, maybe not a reason. You know, it just depends. And it's hard to give, like, straightforward advice, but.
Oh, yeah. The most important question ever. Red or green?
Red all the way.
And if you're going to go somewhere for red, and it can be in Albuquerque, Santa Fe, or anywhere in New Mexico, where would you go? Not a relative's house. We have to say that.
Well, that would be my first.
Yeah,
would be my mom's house. Would be.
It's everybody's mom's house. We can't say it.
The answer. Let me think for a minute. There is some good red chili.
Or what's your favorite food with red chili on it? Do you have, like, a favorite dish that you, like, kind of hold up against the standard of red chili?
Mashed potatoes on Thanksgiving.
With my.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I really like a pork and red chili is very good. I would have to say, I'm thinking about it now because there's, like, three go-to places.
Well, yeah, hit us. Which ones are they?
Well, this might be, like, not the most popular opinion, but I actually really like Los Cuates. I think Los Cuates has good red chili. I think Garcia's has excellent red chili. There's another restaurant, and the name is escaping me, and they have Camino Azul. That's it. Or Cocina Azul. Cocina Azul. That, they have very good red chili.
Nice, nice. Great. Now I'm hungry, so thanks for that.
I'm hungry.
All right. Well,
thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for sharing a lot of things we didn't know and a lot of really interesting things. And I have a lot to think about now. So we appreciate your time and stay safe, Albuquerque.
Hey, Albuquerque, could we ask you a favor? No, you don't have to drop us off at the airport or watch the kids for us, but we just want to know what you think of the What's Up ABQ podcast. Sure, it only takes a little bit of your time to listen to it, but we put hours into creating something that we hope that you'll enjoy. So if you wouldn't mind, please give us a 5-star review on your preferred platform where you listen to us. It would make us happier than Larry Barker uncovering a hidden waste of taxpayer money. Also, we'll be debuting our revamped and remodeled website soon, so stand by for that. And thanks again, Albuquerque. We love you. What's Up ABQ is back. We have more interviews with lovers, creators, doers, and dreamers of ABQ and beyond. In the meantime, follow us on Instagram and send us a message if you or somebody you know is interested in an interview. And as always, we support ABQ locals free of charge. We love you, ABQ. It's good to be back, and we'll be telling you soon, What's Up ABQ?